So I'm here to talk with Professor Paul Shikovskis and to talk about complexity as we understand it in CBT, and this is an introduction to the special issue that will be coming out in early 2018 around complexity. Paul, if we could start with just talking about what you understand by the term complexity in case conceptualisation.
Well, let's talk about what it isn't. Let's talk about what complexity isn't. People often talk about complex cases. And in my view, all cases are complex. So I think what we should be talking about, what the special issue is going to be talking about, as I understand it, are complex problems. So where the problems have developed layers of complexity. A bit more context, I think, here as well. There's a kind of general finding in terms of people viewing their own competency as therapists or as anything else. And what that shows is that, you know, it's Glenn Waller's work, isn't it? That everybody regards themselves as better than average as a therapist, usually a lot better than average. Now, we know that that can't be true. You can't have everybody who's better than average. And so the question is, when people aren't necessarily getting everybody that they work with better, how on earth do they square that with the idea that they're better than average therapists? I think the answer is that people also have a similar distortion about the people they see, that they actually think that they see the most complex cases. So they see people who are not going to get better with simple approaches and so on. So you've got this situation where people think they are the best therapist in the world, and the patients aren't getting better, therefore it must be they have complex cases. So sometimes the idea of a complex case or complex caseload is used as a way of essentially sort of squaring the reality with their own perception of themselves as being fantastically great. And obviously what that also leads to is it leads to people failing to do reflection on their own ability and failing to get proper supervision and failing to therefore improve. So the idea of complex cases, in my view, is unhelpful. The idea of complex problems is helpful, and what I think it usually means is problems that we don't properly understand and that we can't, and that we're not able to use an established pathway with, which might be things like comorbidity, which we'll probably come back to in a minute. So where people have more than one problem, and perhaps where these problems interact with each other in some way. So mainly it's about that, I think. It's mainly about things that we really don't understand yet. So if we look at sort of historically what complex cases were, way back in the 1970s, David Clark and I were working with agoraphobia. Mm. And agoraphobia is regarded as a relatively simple sort of problem. And although the terminology wasn't used, there were people who were regarded as complex cases because they had panic attacks. And people who had panic attacks, either they had panic attacks and no agoraphobic avoidance, so they were complex cases because you couldn't do exposure because they just had panic attacks, or people who had agoraphobia and then when they did exposure they had a panic attack, and what that did is it eroded the effectiveness of the exposure. And so they were regarded as complex cases because their agoraphobia is complicated by panic attacks. Now, I'm giving that example because we're now in the situation where we understand, really as a result of many David Clark's work, really, in the 70s and 80s, we now understand panic to be not at all complex. It's really rather simple. It's one of the simplest and easiest to treat problems. And agoraphobia with panic is as easy to treat as agoraphobia without panic and so on. So what's happened is that our understanding of these complex cases has changed because we now understand them better. So my belief is most of the people we regard as complex cases are simply because we haven't got a framework for understanding them. Therefore, they're complex to us. Mm. We see somebody and we don't know what to do. Mm. And so we have to guddle around. And often we'll end up guddling around with things which are mystical. You know, so we'll look at, for example, deprivation. Now, that's not to say that deprivation and abuse are not important things. It's clear that they are important. But, yeah, it's kind of we know that everybody has grot in their head. I've got grot in my head, you've got grot in your head. And we can make very pretty stories about your depression and my depression and our various problems by the grot in our head, because, you know, we've got abandonment schemas, or we have core beliefs about this, that, and the next thing. The reality is it doesn't really explain anything, because we don't have any of these problems. And when people can't make sense of somebody's panic, agoraphobia, depression, or whatever, then they tend to reach for these complex type of phenomena, which give them an explanation, rather like getting, say, cat. You know, you get this sort of really complex explanation, which then doesn't really lead on to any intervention other than straight CBT. So I think what we're seeing a lot of the time as complex cases are people not understanding, not having a way of conceptualizing things. I'll give you another example of that, because and I think it's one that's really exciting at the moment, and that's within obsessive compulsive disorder, where you and I both work, there's been a development. We were kind of aware there were some people who didn't do very well, and we were sort of aware it linked to sort of, not exactly PTSD, but traumatic events. And then along comes Jack Rackman, and he says, hey guys, we've got this thing called mental contamination. And when you then hear about mental contamination, this rather nice kind of theoretical development, the idea that people are feeling contaminated not because they believe they've got germs on them, but because there's an association, a memory association between a particular object or person or whatever, and something that happened in the past, some unpleasant thing that happened in the past. Then these complex cases who don't respond to exposure and response prevention can be understood in a different way. You can then say, oh, well, what we need to look at are the associations they're making, help them deal with some of those associations, and then move them forward to a response prevention or a standard CBT thing, supplemented by dealing with the images they have of things in the past and so on. And that's really exciting. And there, that's an example where I think we're moving from people having complex problems that we didn't understand to problems which are still not the world's simplest, but that we understand much better. So I'm optimistic about this whole thing about complex cases. I don't think we necessarily have to be more complicated in our approaches, have to do a lot of mumbo-jumbo and, waving hands around in the air kind of stuff. But what we need to do is we need to keep on doing what we're very good at, which is identifying the key processes that are involved in the maintenance of these problems and then intervening with them.
It's very interesting. You're sort of locating complexity more within the therapist and their perception rather than within the client necessarily. And presumably that could also, the complexity could derive, as you say, from lack of supervision or poor supervision or experience or own beliefs. So kind of relocating the source really to the therapist slightly more.
Well, I am in terms of the way it's typically used, yes. But that isn't to say that there aren't people whose problems are very complex. And actually, in a sense, the example I just gave, the mental contamination, almost by definition, those are people who have a complex set of horrible things happening to them. So in a sense, this is almost like it's like there's the imaginary complexity that therapists impose on things and then try to deal with it by kind of going for complex answers. It was like we used to get with things like psychoanalysis, things like, well, CBT is really good for simple problems like specific phobias. But when it comes to more complex problems, you need to have a more complex solution. And that's kind of like, that's just weird, isn't it? Because saying, well, we as psychoanalysts, we can't treat specific phobias, which are rather simple. And we just can't do it. And CBT can, because it takes a simple approach. But when it comes to more complicated things, we must be able to treat those because they're complicated and we use complicated solutions. And that's not a good fit at all. But it's quite clear that in mental health, we've got people who've had a string of bad things happen to them, who may be vulnerable. And it might be, we're kind of into classic stressed athesis thing. There may be some people who are very vulnerable because you could say they have high intolerance of uncertainty, or you could say that they've got sort of traumatic schemas floating around or whatever. But for whatever reason, there are people where the maintenance of their problems are complicated by a range of factors, which are often historical, I think usually historical, and which make it fairly hard to sort of get in there. And again, the mental contamination example is a good example. Like people, for example, have been bullied, abused, betrayed, degraded, and so on, and then there's memories that make them feel contaminated and get into sort of washing type of thing. For example, then it comes down to what your aim in therapy is. When people have had a really horrible life, is our aim to wipe out the effects of that horrible life, or is it to remove the obstacles to them reclaiming their life and moving forward and having a better quality of life? And this, it's a question that really goes to kind of the fundamental nature of what we do. If somebody say, I mean, right now we've got a wave of horror coming into this country and the rest of Europe. We've got people who've been in Syria, who've been displaced from comfortable existences and who've perhaps witnessed horrific things, may have seen relatives tortured and so on and so on. And then a lot of those people, not all of them interestingly, but a lot of those people will then have mental health problems, and we've got those to deal with coming in. And then the question is, what's the aim? If you've got somebody who has, you know, is depressed and has PTSD and perhaps some obsessional problems on top, and is, you know, has what we call comorbidity, what can we actually, you know, what's our end point? Is our end point restoring them to, you know, the sort of comfortable life that you and I have had, you know, so that actually we can live in that way? Or is it something different? And I think the answer is that it's probably something different. We're aiming for the best that we can. And I think as the medical profession and the psychotherapeutic professions and clinical psychology or whatever you want to look at haven't entirely resolved what we can do with those things. And some of these issues are moral and political issues. So what I'm saying is that there are people who have really, really complex sets of problems, made complicated by what's happened to them, or made complicated by the reactions that they've had to those. Because I think you can get to the same place. Not because you've had, you know, a terrible time in war zones or by being a refugee, but because you're super sensitive, and therefore, you know, the things which perhaps wouldn't bother many people bother them, and then compound and interact with those, and you're kind of left with something about what your aims are in therapy.
So there's almost a risk that by focusing on a complicated formulation, that could get in the way of an intervention.
Yeah. I mean, both experience and research point to the same thing, really, which is that if somebody comes in with a particular problem, and it's up to them to find the problem, somebody comes in and says, I'm agoraphobic, and, you know, and I have panic attacks, then you should always start with that, and then you should be trying to do this thing that in cognitive behavior therapy we call a formulation. And I'm really talking about cognitive behavior formulations, which I think are nicely empirically grounded. I think there are other approaches to formulation which are not empirically grounded, and which aren't as helpful. But anyway, you do this thing you call formulation, and then if you can successfully get a shared understanding from that formulation with the service user, with the person that you're trying to help, then you can go ahead and help them deal with that panic, agoraphobia, depression, or whatever it is. What you will often find with some of these people with more complicated problems is that it's really difficult to get to that formulation, and actually it's not satisfactory. And, you know, you, under those circumstances, then you probably need to think about, you know, reappraising that formulation and moving to more complicated thing. And that's where things like generalized assumptions or conditional assumptions start to come in. When you're not able to formulate on the basis of simple maintenance factors, the majority of cases we see in mental health, even like in my case where I'm doing tertiary work, you know, we actually can get to a simple maintenance formulation. And we can do it. I'd say 70% of the people who have defined, almost by definition, people referred into our service are regarded as complex cases, or people with complex problems. 70% of them, you can do a straight maintenance formulation, and then you can deal with it. And that is always where you should start. And it's when you get stuck with that you then move to more complicated type of interventions. There's a joke, which kind of rather summarizes, because you do get people, say, who've got the thing that's often called personality disorder, which is a term I personally don't like because of some of its implications. But let's say you're enduring complicated problems. And one of the things we know is that people with the thing we call personality disorders, they actually do rather well in treatment. So people, there's the Dutch research from Arno Arts and Renzo Hoekstra, people like that, showing that people who have, say, anxiety disorders, presenting with anxiety disorder, they have borderline personality disorder as well, diagnosable according to whatever, that they start out, their anxiety starts out more severe than people who don't have these other problems. And in treatment, it improves at exactly the same rate as people who don't have that other diagnosis. But because it started out more severe, they improve to a point actually rather like people who didn't have that. But then the other thing that that group showed us was that if you then carried on with the anxiety treatment, that they would continue to improve, and it didn't really interfere with it. And of course, you're very familiar with some of the work that we've done on, say, on obsessive compulsive personality disorder, where we, so-called, where we actually found that people who had OCPD alongside OCD did significantly better than people who didn't have that. And that's probably because what we were actually seeing in this thing we called OCPD was perfectionism, which is a strength. Being perfectionistic in a particular form in terms of persistence is really helpful. The other example, which you're particularly familiar with, is when people, say, have developed the problems at a very early age. So you and I did some work on people with early onset OCD, so before the age of 12 or after the age of 16, so cutting out the puberty thing. And the clinical folklore is that people with personality disorder or people with early onset OCD, they're not going to do as well when you see them as adults because it got complicated. And as you know, what we found was that just was not true. Yeah, they started out more severe and they improved more. And so what that also tells us is the complexity of cases is in the eye of the beholder. So, and we're back to clinicians see it as complex. And I think one of the things that happens is somebody comes with early onset OCD or OCPD or borderline personality disorder diagnosis attached to them. And what happens is that when people sit down and start to try and reach a shared understanding, the therapist's heart sinks. And they think, oh no, this is not going to go so well. And the service user looking at them picks it up. I think they actually pick it up. And again, that links to some other research we've done looking at when we lied to people about a piece of video and said this person is complex because they've got a borderline personality disorder, and that was actually something you didn't. Then the therapist became more pessimistic and so on. So, to my point, I'll take a long time to get there, but there's another thing about this, and the joke is about the guy who goes to a surgeon with a hand problem. And he says, the surgeon says, well, we're going to have to operate on your hand. And the patient says, well, can I just check, will I be able to play the piano after the operation? And the surgeon says, yes, of course you will. And the patient says, well, that's good, because I can't play it now. Now, kind of the point of that is, I suppose, that if you've got somebody, say, who has long-term difficulties with self-esteem or self-compassion, or whatever you want to call it, and difficulties in forming stable relationships, and so on. The thing that sometimes gets labelled as borderline personality disorder, there's absolutely no reason to believe that if they're coming in for OCD or depression or anxiety or whatever, they won't do well. However, in many cases, you'll then find that they still then have difficulty making relationships, and a lot of those difficulties are there. It's not always true. I mean, of course, there is some research, say, on avoidant personality disorder, so-called, say, social phobia, where after you've treated the social phobia, the avoidant personality disorder, in 70% of the cases, I recall, is no longer there. You could say, well, that's a miracle and it shows how good the therapy is. But what it actually probably says is that this diagnosis of avoidant personality disorder is confused, that it's linked into the into the primary diagnosis, social phobia or whatever. So what I'm saying is it's complicated, but it's not as complicated as we think.
It must be in the same way as we're used to understanding that terms personality disorders can have negative connotations. Do you think there's a risk that the term complexity, when you read about it in a referral or at a team meeting, or you're given, or you're told about patients complex, has potentially similar negative connotations for a therapist?
I think it depends on the therapist, doesn't it? I mean, I think it could, because if you read complex case, the question is, well, how you interpret that. And I think we should be training therapists to disregard that kind of information. I mean, it's one of the things my preference is not to read much in the way of notes before I meet somebody to form my own opinion, but then read the notes because you kind of want to know what's there. So I like to know kind of generally what other people think the problem might be, but then form my own opinion. So yes, I think it is the case that we might just end up moving from saying, okay, well, we'll no longer use the term personality disorder, we'll use the term complex cases. And so it just develops the same meaning, which is people who we're not going to be able to help, or not be able to help easily, and so on. And then again, we're back to this thing about it probably directly impacts on therapeutic relationship. Now, I'm not a fan of Bruce Wampold. I don't believe, for example, that, that it's all about therapeutic relationship. It clearly isn't. However, a good therapeutic relationship is necessary but not sufficient. In other words, if you're going to work with somebody, it's really important that they feel they can trust you, and you feel you have a good understanding of them, and so on. Now, just that isn't going to help people, because then you can go and have a cup of coffee and do nothing, or do flower fairy therapy, or whatever it is. But then you have to go further with that. Now, of course, the reason we've got the so-called Dodo Bird verdict is because essentially there's been a failure of critical thinking. If we look at, say, specific phobias, the Dodo Bird verdict does not apply to specific phobias. If you do 2 hours of focused CBT, then 70% of people get better. If you do 2 hours of being nice to somebody and talking about their childhood, they're not going to get better. Same for OCD. So what we've got is, apparently everybody gets better because of the therapeutic alliance, except for, and then you've got a bunch of exceptions. So it's no longer everybody. Now, I think where you get the Dodo Bird verdict coming in, it's in depression. And the thing about depression is that we're not very good at treating it. We're actually pretty rubbish at treating it. So I think the therapeutic alliance has its biggest impact where the treatment doesn't work very well, or maybe doesn't work at all. And then you can refer that to the work of Rob DeRubis. And Rob DeRubis pointed out, and indeed he's got nice experimental data showing, that the therapeutic alliance is linked to outcome, and that's because good outcome results in good therapeutic alliance. So if I get better, if I go see my doctor for my ingrown toenail, and I get better, I like my doctor, I give him a bottle of whiskey at the end of it all or whatever, and so on. Whereas if he doesn't get better, I really think he's a bit of a useless doctor and so on. So I think what we're seeing in these terms is the therapeutic alliance is necessary but not sufficient, that you get relationships between therapeutic alliance and outcome for a particular reason, which is that good outcomes give you good therapeutic alliances. I think the evidence is pretty compelling for that. You can interfere with the therapeutic alliance by saying this is an impossible patient. You've got a complex case and you're not going to be able to use usual tools. It disempowers you as a therapist. If you say, well, this is a complex case, and all these things which are highly effective, and which, nice guidelines and research tell us are going to work, well, you can't use those because it's a complex case. And that's based on some other clinical mythology. The other clinical mythology is that the research data does not apply to routine clinical practice. And all the evidence is that it actually applies rather well. I mean, we've got Nick Gray, for example, doing a lot of work with other people, myself included, at CADAC, showing that actually in routine practice you can get the same kind of effects as you get in elsewhere. Now, in research studies, we've also got, we had this great example when we did work with our Danish colleagues, where we we decided we'd try and generalise, and again, Nick and I have done this with panic, we also did it with health anxiety in Denmark, and we took a non-research clinic and we taught them how to teach health anxiety, and we demonstrated that in 16 cases, we demonstrated that these patients in the non-research clinic did just as well as the patients in the research trials. Now, what was interesting was the reaction of our their colleagues, because then when these data were presented, what their colleague says, oh, well, of course you got those results because you're a research clinic. They said, no, we're not a research clinic. They said, yeah, you are. You just did that research in a research clinic. And that is a really important point, because what that says is that every clinic should be a research clinic. And that's one of the things that IAPT has done, actually. It's turned every clinic into a research clinic, because they're right. Research clinics do better. And it's not because they're research clinics. It's because they're very careful about problem identification. They do careful monitoring. They make sure that the therapists are supervised. Treatment integrity is matched. So you're not allowed to go too much off-piste in a research trial. You're not just allowed to sort of push off and do fire fairy therapy because you think that the patient's complex or whatever. So I think, yeah, that one of the things that the notion of complex cases does is it allows therapists to go off-piste. And they're allowed to do any sort of elaborate sort of stuff. There's this really nice work from Dietmar Schulte, which shows, for example, that when therapy gets tough, therapists often go off-piste. And the therapists think they've done a really good session. Sadly, the patients then think those sessions are not good. Mm. So the more people stick to protocol, the better the patients think it is. The more people go off protocol, the better they think the therapists think therapy is.
So should we be including therapists in our conceptualization, formalization? Should we include therapists' beliefs about complexity or other labels within it to kind of work out how that itself is interacting with all the other patient factors? And
yeah, I think that's entirely right. I think we need to, therapist beliefs should be part of the way we, at least we embed our formulation. A good example of that would be Blake Stobie's work on with OCD. So Blake and I were looking at therapist beliefs and how those might interact with what they thought the appropriate therapy was. And it turns out you can derail these as well. So one of the things we did was we just gave people, Blake and also Daniel Lam and I, this where we gave people information, for example, where we characterised the problem as being more biological. And it changed the way that people saw the patient. So yes, I think we do need to be starting to think about our own beliefs and actually finding ways of neutralizing those or treating the therapist or whatever. The best way, of course, is the thing that cognitive behavior therapists do particularly well, which is live supervision. Because to some degree, one of the things that happens is when you listen to a tape and you see somebody's really given up, therapist has given up, then you pick that up in a supervision tape.